both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're starting this week of morning show interviews with something that I think will be very, very interesting indeed. And I'm pleased to make the acquaintance this morning for the first time with Sean Reardon, who is Manager of Business Intelligence here at Gateway Technical College. And there is a lot wrapped up in that intriguing job title. And there are, in effect, Sean Reardons all over the place in all kinds of companies and institutions of higher learning, all kinds of organizations. He is charged with helping to guide Gateway's exploration of data in terms of figuring out how to plan for its future. And so we'll talk quite a lot about the work that Sean Reardon does. What prompted this invitation to Sean Reardon to come on the morning show is that he presented at a administrative in-service here at Gateway a few weeks ago a very striking and dramatic report called The Demographic Drought, which examines many of the causes of the woes that we see right now in the labor market with all kinds of companies that cannot find enough workers. And it is happening everywhere and in every sector of our economy. And of course, it's getting worse. And this report seeks to sort out some of the long-term trends, which were part of that, and the role that COVID played, that is the pandemic, in maybe accelerating some of those trends and making a already challenging situation even worse. And the report goes on to highlight some of the ways in which this is likely to change, and in other ways not change at all or only get worse, and what we can do about it. It's a really fascinating report, again called The Demographic Drought. I hasten to add, Sean Reardon did not author this report. He merely presented it in his role here at Gateway as Manager of Business Intelligence. So he is thoroughly acquainted with it, and so we will be talking through some of the major points of it a little bit later in the hour. In the meantime, Sean Reardon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I'm really glad that you accepted the invitation to come on the program. I have to say, I'm absolutely fascinated by the sort of the concept of what you do here at Gateway. And so I do want to spend some time talking about what you do, even apart from this report that you presented recently. Let's start with actually kind of who you are and where you're from originally and the kind of interests that you have had all along that sort of fueled you and maybe funneled your energies towards doing this kind of work.
Certainly. So I grew up in a west suburb of Chicago called Glen Ellen, and went to Illinois State University for my undergrad, where I studied political science and English.
Down in, is that Bloomington Normal? Or
yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And then a few years later for grad school, I went to the other Bloomington, Indiana, where I studied higher education and statistics. So I've always had some interest in statistics and demographic trends kind of baked into my education. And coming out of grad school, I took a job at Gateway. So originally when I came here, I was a research analyst. And since then, I've become the manager of business intelligence.
And so is it fairly typical for a college or like Gateway or liberal arts schools or state universities, whatever, to have somebody like you on the staff?
Yeah, it's pretty common. I'd say that what the responsibilities of our office, which is institutional research, the responsibilities of institutional research might vary a bit from school to school, but overall, they analyze data, they might fulfill internal or external data requests, state and federal reporting, stuff like that.
Hmm. So growing up, did you have, for instance, a real interest in math? Is that tied into this interest in statistics, or does your interest in statistics sort of flow in the other direction or from the other direction?
I wouldn't say it's an interest in math. I've never really considered myself to be very good at math, but statistics isn't math, luckily for me. But I always had an interest in demographic trends. Like I said, I was a political science major in undergrad, and there are a lot of trends and you know, predictive modeling and stuff like that that goes into those studies.
Right. So when you first came to Gateway as, you said, a research analyst, what would be, in a sense, a typical day for you? What sorts of assignments would cross your desk? What kinds of things would you be analyzing, and in what way?
A lot of the time, maybe a faculty member or a staff member would reach out to me looking to have a question answered with Gateway's data, which isn't necessarily widely available to everyone. And so some of my job was helping to distribute that data and make sure that the people who need it have it. Some other things that I did that supported that were built data visualizations and interactive dashboards using Gateway's data that people can easily access and use to help make decisions.
So are you saying by visualization, the creation of like graphs and charts that would make sense and not misrepresent data?
Yeah, along those lines, yes.
Because I mean, I don't know a lot about data collection or analyzation, but I know enough to know that it's possible to take, for instance, one of those graphs with a climbing line, and if you present it one way, it looks like this very gradual whatever, and you can maybe chop it off in terms of the amount of time that depicted, and suddenly it looks like a soaring aberration. And I suppose that's part of what you have to do as you visualize data or make it visual, is that you are representing it fairly and accurately.
Yes, absolutely. And you always want people to have proper context for what you're showing them.
Right. So some of what you were dealing with was data generated by Gateway itself, about its internal affairs and, I suppose, things like enrollment and retention and so on.
Yes, that's correct. We report data to the WTCS system office, the same as all the other WTCS schools do. And we also report our data to IPEDS, which is essentially the federal government.
Of course, what draws you to the morning show today is about data that was not generated by Gateway, but that came from outside. And before we get to this specific report again called the Demographic Drought, how often and under what circumstances does this kind of outside data come into Gateway? And is part of what you do in your job to kind of sort through it and make sense of it?
Well, there is a data tool that Gateway has a subscription to. It's called MC. And what it is it is labor market statistics, essentially, and you can filter them out by the type of occupation, the type of program that generates it, even down to job postings. And a lot of the time we use it for either program development or grant reporting. There are a number of uses that we have for MC's data, but once in a while they'll publish a report. And the Demographic Drought is an example of a report that they published probably around April or May of this year. And, you know, I get emails from them. And when I got this email, it sounded like it would be something pretty important and interesting to me. So I read through it all 60 plus pages.
And it really is interesting. And we'll dive into it in a moment. So I suppose for a place like Gateway Technical College or Parkside or Carthage, labor market statistics, and I suppose these matter even more to Gateway, since Gateway is so much about career preparation, is about understanding what the needs are out there in the greater economy and in the greater labor market. So can you think of maybe a tangible example of data generated by this group called MC that would be a very specific assistance to a place like Gateway in terms of making programming or curricular choices or whatever?
Well, for example, let's say Gateway wants to develop a new program and introduce a new program. What we'll do is we'll look in MC to see where potential job openings are in Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties. And then we look at that and see where there is a need that is not being met by existing programs, not just at Gateway, but at other colleges in the Tri-County area, and develop programs and other opportunities based on what those needs are, so that the labor market gets its needs met and students can become enrolled in programs that they are very likely to graduate and get a job in.
Very good. So the data that comes in from a place like MC, this is highly regarded in the field, and so everything they generate, as far as you're concerned, is absolutely trustworthy and does not need to be, in a sense, curated carefully.
Yes, I'd consider it very reputable data.
Right. Does other data come into Gateway, even sort of unrequested, that you have to kind of sort through, or by and large, do you stick to kind of known quantities that are trustworthy?
I mean, we definitely stick to data sources and data tools that we're familiar with. But if other data does come in, usually we vet it just to make sure that everything that's on there checks out, that it's from a reputable source, that the assumptions that they make when they collect the data all add up.
And what is the work that you're doing now since assuming this new position in earlier this year compared to what you were doing before?
So essentially now I help coordinate the college's strategy for data. And that still does include creating data visualizations like before. But now it's more of the philosophy behind, okay, so we're making this visualization. What do we want the purpose of it to be? Who's the audience for it? And do the people who have do the people who need data have data? So I'd say it's more of being proactive in addressing data needs and making sure that people who come to our office with a need have that need met. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Sean Reardon, who is Manager of Business Intelligence here at Gateway Technical College. He's been with Gateway since 2018. He assumed his current position earlier this year. And what prompted the invitation to Sean Reardon to come on the morning show today was a presentation that he made in an administrative in-service here at Gateway back in early or mid-October. My boss here, the general manager, Dave Cole, was at that in-service and was really blown away by the presentation that Sean made of this report from MC called The Demographic Drought, How the Approaching Sandsdemic Will Transform the Labor Market for the Rest of Our Lives. And of course, I suspect one of the things that caught your eye was that strange word that I'm not even sure is a word, but maybe it will be a word from now on, sansdemic, S-A-N-S-D-E-M-I-C. Explain to our listeners what is behind that term.
So essentially, the root of the word sansdemic is from Latin, and sansdemic essentially means without people. And the reason that this term has come into use, to make a long story short, is that the U.S. population is in the process of shrinking. And this will affect every aspect of our lives, including the labor market, higher education, the economy in general, et cetera. Perhaps you've seen it in your life if you go to a restaurant nowadays and maybe the dining room is closed because they don't have enough staff to operate.
Right, exactly. And help wanted signs are everywhere and so on. In the introduction to the report, they make reference to something called the COVID paradox. And if I understand correctly, we're talking about something in which there was a situation in the labor market and then COVID hit, and we should have expected one thing to occur, but it didn't. Something else has occurred instead, and some people sort of call that the COVID paradox. Can you unlock that term for us about and kind of explain what is surprising about the current situation in the wake of the worst of the COVID pandemic?
So in the context of higher education, what's interesting about what's happened during the pandemic is that typically when the economy struggles, enrollment in higher education goes up because people are planning to go back to school so that they can change careers and then get back into the labor market when conditions are better. But with COVID, that hasn't happened. Enrollment all across higher education is down. And so that is something that a lot of people did not expect.
Right. They would have expected just the opposite for the economy to go up. And I guess part of this, in terms of the employment world, what's so strange at the moment is that you have millions of people not working or out of work, and you have millions of job postings that are unfilled, and millions of people who are just sort of walking away from the labor market altogether. And it sounds like this is something we haven't really seen before.
Yeah, it's definitely something new. And the reason for that is that for many decades, the United States population was exponentially increasing, pretty much since post-World War II with the baby boomer generation. People were having families of four or five kids or more. Whereas now, people are having fewer children or not having children. And so we're basically at a point where we have an aging population, but we don't have a younger population to replace them. So a lot of the infrastructure that our society has built, it's now fallen out of use, essentially.
Right. It's as though we structured our country, our society, our labor market, our economy around this robust population growth, and that is not there anymore. And suddenly we don't have the people, in a sense, to populate what we have built and what once fit us pretty well. In this introduction to this report, again called The Demographic Drought, they say that it really is a mistake to call this the COVID paradox, because COVID didn't cause any of these problems. COVID was just an accelerant, which is such an interesting term.
Yes, that's correct. COVID did not create any of these conditions. These conditions were well in place for decades before COVID hit, but it did accelerate all of these trends. And there are three major trends in particular that it accelerated. The first one being baby boomers leaving the workforce. So like I said before, aging population ages out of the workforce, not being replaced by the younger population. Going along with that, record low labor participation rates. Fewer and fewer people are even looking for work at all. And then right now we have the lowest birth rates in U.S. history. And they've been declining for a while, and right now they're at their low point. So our population isn't going to be bouncing back up anytime soon.
Right. And it's one of the things that's a point made at the end of the report is even if tomorrow everybody started having babies, that doesn't solve anything in terms of the labor market for a good 18 years at least. So, and I think this introductory portion ends with a really good turn of phrase when it says this is not the COVID paradox. This is history catching up with us. In other words, these have been trends that were in place for a while, and were we just not paying attention, or was it sort of a far off something that now is suddenly on top of us? I suppose maybe you're too young to even be able to answer a question like that because, you know, in terms of analyzing the data, you're relatively new to the scene. But
well, I think it's the latter of what you said. I mean, I think during the baby boomer generation, a lot of norms in American society were kind of redefined. So hugely booming population. So to compete with other people, you had to go to college and earn a degree and get a good job and get a full-time job and accumulate wealth and buy a house and have children. But now that isn't really true of the current generation that's entering the workforce.
That scenario just isn't the same. It doesn't feel the same. It doesn't look the same. And so they are acting in very different ways. We're speaking with Sean Reardon here at Gateway Technical College about a report which he presented to an administrative in-service a few weeks ago, the report from MC called The Demographic Drought, How the Approaching Sans-Demic Will Transform the Labor Market for the Rest of Our Lives. And essentially, the sans-demic, that term refers to, in a sense, kind of the disappearance of people from the scene. We were just talking about baby boomers, and I really appreciated that a whole chapter of this report is devoted to the baby boomers, of which I am one, since baby boomers are roughly those born between 1946 and 1964, and I was born in 1960, so I'm towards the end of the baby boomers. And one of the things for us to understand about the boomers and the labor market that they help shape is you know, among other things, this dramatic influx of women into the workforce. What kind of difference has that made in terms of kind of changing the whole scenario of who is working and how many jobs are out there and so on?
It's completely redefined everything in our culture. I mean, it also means more competition for existing jobs. But also, in the 50s and 60s, men were the primary earners of their families. So women would rely on marriage in order to economically support themselves. But now they can support themselves by getting a job and working, and so marriage is not as essential for them. And so that leads to less marriage, and less marriage leads to less children, and less children leads to everything that I've been describing up to this point.
Right. In this chapter about the baby boomers, they talk about how they were this labor force explosion that powerfully shaped hiring norms. It's like the way people hired people, the way people looked for talent led to these norms, which at one point in the report are termed as deeply entrenched norms. What would be at least one or two of the most significant?
So I mentioned before that as a result of the baby boom, college attendance soared dramatically. So in order to compete, people would need some form of degree. And when they did that, they would go to college and learn a specific skill set and then search for opportunities based on those skills. Now, having this many qualified workers available meant that businesses could be very selective in who they hired for their open positions. And then this became even easier when internet job postings became a thing in the early 2000s. Companies could cast their nets even wider than before, and applicants could find position listings much more easily. So businesses grew, and these were kind of the norms that shaped talent acquisition for many decades.
Right. And of course, you have this structure that's built for this explosion of people, and in the sense an explosion of talent. And now we find things dramatically receding, and we have these structures in place and not the people necessary to populate them. In this chapter is also conversation about how there are so many baby boomers and there aren't enough younger people just numerically to replace them. This chapter also talks about the fact that the baby boomers generated a tremendous amount of wealth. And this has been a contributor too, because of course, ultimately the children of baby boomers most of the time inherit that wealth, and that can have a great impact on whether or not then those children of boomers enter the labor market at all.
Yes, absolutely. So the labor force participation rate among men has dropped about 5 percentage points in the last 40 or so years, which doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking about millions of people who are no longer employed and looking for a job. And like you said, one of the main reasons for that is boomer wealth. And because essentially it has de-incentivized millennials to go out and find a job and build their own wealth, because they can just live with their parents or ultimately inherit their parents' money. And so they don't have the economic motivators to work that their parents did. Doesn't mean they're lazy, but it does mean that the factors that brought their parents into the workforce are not there for them.
Right. I really want to explore some more of the second chapter, which is titled The Remarkable Erosion of the Prime Age Male Workforce. And this chapter also goes on to say that lots of women have left the labor market in recent years too, but in some ways what is even more striking is how many males have left the workforce. And this is also a trend that extends over some years. This is not just something in the last couple of years, but just how dramatic an exodus are we talking about?
Well, like I said, millions of people who were in the labor market before no longer are. But there's really been kind of a shift in attitude among millennials as far as what they're looking for in a job. So essentially, millennials have prioritized their own happiness and mental health, I guess, over money. And so they look more for part-time work. So part-time work has increased dramatically in the last couple of decades as people leave full-time work.
In other words, there are many, many more part-time jobs than there once were?
Yes.
And that's partly because that's what more people want. I suppose that's part of it. I suppose the other thing is, for a company, it's often cheaper to have a part-time position.
Yes, absolutely. And like I said, these businesses are struggling to fill their positions, so they fill them bit by bit as much as they can with part-time work.
Right. This chapter mentions something that is such a striking possibility, and that is that, and this might help explain why we are especially seeing this with males being disinterested either in employment at all or in having full-time jobs. And it's because of this very neat and probably not coincidental rise in the use of video games as we see this plummet in labor market participation. Tell us more about that correlation.
Yes. Yeah, so essentially, the average number of hours that people play video games has increased at about the same rate as the labor force participation rate has decreased. So those two things could be related. I love video games, but I am still employed. But in general, this is part of the attitude shift away from full-time work and toward part-time work, and video games are a good way to unwind when you're not at work. But another thing that is a factor for the decline in the labor force participation rate is opioids.
Right. And this sounds like it's actually a very, very serious situation. I mean, I think anybody who follows the news has at least some awareness of this horrific epidemic that is affecting all facets of our country. But this report actually really puts some hard numbers in place in terms of just how many males are absent from the labor market right now, very specifically because of opioid abuse.
Yeah, so essentially what's happened is that between 1999 and 2010, opioid sales quadrupled. So this was a factor that was even 30 years ago wasn't really in play, but now it's hugely affected the labor market. The statistic that they give in the report is that 90 people die from opioid overdoses every day. And over a long period of time, that's thousands and thousands of people who are now not working, not in the economy at all. And so the workforce has declined considerably, and it can be directly linked to opioid use.
Right. And that's so frightening. And although now we are aware of this and trying to take steps to curb it, and I think there are some promising signs that maybe the worst is behind us, but by no means does that sort of instantly solve this really terrible situation. So a couple different addictions we're talking about. Addiction to opioids, and then on the other hand, a maybe more benign kind of addiction. But when it comes to impact on the labor market, this addiction to video games, and of course, part of the whole thing of video games is you can lose yourself in them for hours, days, even weeks at a time, and that just does not fold into being a participant in the labor market in the way that we've always traditionally thought of that.
Yes, there's a lot to unpack there with their mention of video games, and I'd imagine there are other factors that kind of feed into that, mental health and things of that nature. But it definitely is something that has contributed in the attitude shift away from full-time work and toward part-time work.
Right. The other thing then that, of course, the report explores and in very interesting detail in Chapter 3, it's titled Living Below 2.1. And explain that magic number of 2.1. It is crucial for understanding this overall situation.
So 2.1 is basically the replacement level birth rate. It's the birth rate that our country would need to have to not change its population at all. So if you're above that 2.1 rate, as we were after the baby boom, your population will increase exponentially.
And of course, this is looking at the traditional paradigm of two parents, two children.
Yes.
And those two children replace you, and someday you're no longer around.
Yes, the nuclear family,
right,
as they say. But then if you have a birth rate below 2.1, which we do, then over a long period of time, your population will decline. Now, other countries have dealt with the same thing. You may have heard about Japan or Europe experiencing similar declines in their population, where they have a smaller young population caring for a larger older population. Those countries are about 20 years ahead of where we are.
So much of what they're experiencing can be perhaps of some help to us. And so, yeah, and the report says that we have actually been at or below 2.1 as a birth rate for the last 50 years. So this is, again, that matter of history really catching up with us. And the report, I appreciated how it goes on to explain some of the trends that have really exacerbated this, things like urbanization and secularization that have contributed to this declining birth rate, which I found really interesting.
Yes. So as you probably are aware, our society has become less agrarian over the last 100 or so years. Most work used to be done in farms, whereas now industry has taken over, and so most people live in and near cities. And you can see this in population trends, where most of the counties in the United States that have lost population are in rural areas, former farming communities, whereas cities and, to a lesser extent, suburbs have grown considerably in population. Now, urbanization is associated with higher living costs, so parents can afford fewer children, so they have fewer children, which contributes to our population not replacing itself.
Right. So we think of cities as sometimes kind of crowded, and it's just not the place where you feel maybe comfortable having 5, 6, 7, 8 children. And when you're in the beautiful open lands of Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska, it's just, there's just sort of a different mindset in place, and all of this sort of comes together. Well, in the unhappy chapter titled Grim Implications, the fourth chapter of this report, it really goes on to outline the ways in which all of us and the quality of our lives is going to be, for the most part, adversely affected. I suppose there are ways in which maybe we could be affected in other ways, but for the most part, adversely affected by this demographic shift or demographic drought that we've been talking about. Highlight a few of the most important in your estimation.
Well, some of them are things that we're already seeing, and a lot of them will be kind of quality of life things that you notice. Like if you order a package and it doesn't come on time because they don't have a truck driver, It'll be things like that. Or you go to a restaurant and they're short-staffed, so their hours are reduced. Those are the less harmful ways that it'll affect us. The worst ways in which it'll affect us will be stuff like there's a shortage of doctors and nurses, and so you can't get an essential surgery that you need when you need it.
That's pretty scary.
Yes.
And I suppose we're also talking about things like there's fewer people to develop new medications or develop new medical procedures or other innovations that touch on every aspect of our lives. Although I don't think we tend to think about those sectors of the economy, you know, in that way. I think it, for most of us, it's when we try to drive through Burger King and they're shut down because they don't have enough staff that day, which I've seen that happen 3 times in the last week in the Burger King just a few blocks away from here. But that's, as you say, that's a relatively minor inconvenience compared to some of the other implications that are possible here.
Yes, and less people in general means less of all the good things that people can do, like, you know, technological innovation, scientific discoveries, leadership. Every person has a chance to do something like that. So when you have less people, you have less chances for things of that nature.
Right. In this chapter, the sentence that jumped out at me was at the end when they said, economies are built by people. Economies are people. And that seems so basic, and yet it sounds like that is a basic truth that has been either forgotten or neglected for a long, long time, and suddenly we are realizing that and maybe realizing it too late.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for the last several decades, the focus of the economy has been to generate wealth, but perhaps it has lost sight of the people who keep the economy up and running and meeting their needs, and now there's a reckoning at hand.
Right. No kidding. The fifth and final chapter of this report talks about trying to look for an oasis in the midst of this demographic drought. And although they do give some cause for hope here and there, they do, in a sense, sort of disavow us of the notion that, oh, well, I think the answer is this, or the answer is this, a couple of relatively easy fixes that, in fact, we should not depend upon. One of them that the report talks about is immigration.
Yes. So a lot of the time there's this assumption that our worker shortages can be solved with immigration, which immigration has slowed some of these trends, but it hasn't reversed them. And the reason for that is that the demographic trends that are affecting the United States are also affecting the rest of the world, including places where we get a lot of our immigrants from, China, Mexico, India. A lot of them are experiencing similar demographic declines, and those workers are now able to find work in their home country and have no incentive to come here. Or at least less of an incentive to come here. Right.
Or at least in some of these places where we've had a very strong influx, that influx is very likely will lessen over time as the situation changes in their home countries. The report also cautions us to not just blithely assume that technology is going to solve our problems. Although this is an interesting point, because oddly, so much hand-wringing has gone on about the dangers of too much automation and that of jobs going away because we suddenly have robots that can do these things that people once did. And now suddenly we're being, in a sense, told the reverse.
Well, I think it's dependent on the situation. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time when you automate something, you also need, human. There needs to be a human element there supervising it.
And I suppose a very skilled human supervising or programming or whatever their responsibilities are.
Yeah, for more complex tasks, that's definitely true. But even for something like if you've been to the grocery store recently, they have self-checkout lines. Mm. So that's something that used to not be automated that now is automated. But you still have staff at the grocery store who are overseeing the checkout lines and maybe troubleshooting if you have a problem. So even though this function is now automated, the human element isn't removed from it completely.
Right. And you must absolutely have. And of course, there's other elements of a grocery store that are not automated, or at least not yet automated. But yeah, I suppose that's the thing. There are certain things that a robot can do, and there's other things that a robot simply cannot do. And that is what has to be sorted out. But we can't just automate our way out of this situation. So despite the way this chapter kind of discards a couple of what we would think of as relatively easy fixes or quick fixes, it does offer some thoughts on what we need to do better in order to make this situation more tolerable. So what is it pointing the way towards for us?
Now, the point that it makes at the very end of the report is that moving forward, it's going to be a workers' economy, which means that people in the labor market can be more selective about where they work. Because before, companies could be selective about who they hired, but now because there's a worker shortage, the opposite is true. So essentially what companies need to do is offer a compelling reason for people to work there. And maybe that's benefits or flexible work arrangements. And then also companies need to be able to think outside the box in hiring, maybe just because someone doesn't have a degree that is specific to what the company needs them to do. Maybe they could still hire this person and then train them to do the functions that they don't yet know how to do.
Mm.
So worker training on the job, I think, is going to become much more common.
Right. Reskilling and upskilling, which they which they talk about. Why did you want to present this report to Gateway Technical College? In what way do you see this as useful, important information for Gateway as it moves forward? What are the implications suggested in this chapter for a place like Gateway?
Well, one of the main functions of Gateway is to supply the local economy with workers. So our partners in Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties in industry, they need workers. They're going to be affected by this, and we will play a huge role in bridging that gap between their needs and what workers in the labor market are looking for, and to make sure that students coming out of Gateway have the skills that they need to fill those positions.
And I noticed that a couple of the points made that really are applicable to higher education are things like recruiting outside of traditional demographics, which, of course, you were probably touching on that when you were talking about companies maybe hiring someone that doesn't specifically have the degree that is called for. But for especially schools like Carthage and Parkside, it seems, because Gateway, I think, already very much thinks outside that traditional box of 18 to 22-year-olds. But all schools of higher education, and probably even Gateway, needs to think even more about that.
Yes. Like I said before, because birth rates are declining, they'll have fewer traditional high school age students to draw from for their enrollment, which, like you said, Gateway already does cast a pretty wide net as far as student recruitment, but more traditional four-year institutions might struggle because they've been built for a specific purpose, you know, with residence halls and other infrastructure that's really geared for students coming out of high school. And so other schools might have to cast a wider net, and that'll create competition between colleges to attract students.
Right, the so-called war on talent. The line in this last chapter that really jumped out at me was that as much as anything, what this comes down to is that we need to value people more, which I thought was really interesting in a chapter that has lots of statistics and so on and a lot of grim realities with which we have to grapple. But that idea that's what this all leads to valuing people more. Were you kind of surprised when you got to the end of this report to see that that was the conclusion it drawn?
Not too surprised, because even when you're dealing with statistics, every statistic is someone's personal story, ultimately. Hmm. And if you've seen this play out in your own life or with people that you know, it's not too hard to imagine that it could be affecting people all over the country or all over the world as well.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting to see what colleges, employers, and others are going to do with this situation as we all try to move forward in some way that makes sense. And I really appreciate the conversation that we've had today and the really interesting information that you helped to present. Again, from this report called The Demographic Drought, prepared by a data gathering group called MC. Sean Reardon, Manager of Business Intelligence here at Gateway Technical College. I really appreciate you joining me today on the morning show to talk about this really, really interesting report. You've really helped us make sense of it, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been my pleasure, Greg. Thanks for having me.